Hello and welcome. I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. In this episode, we're discussing the shocking revelations of the final episode of The State vs. Sean Thomas. In Premeditated, we learned more about the true nature of Domingo's murder and the seemingly calculated machinations of law enforcement officials to railroad Sean, resulting in his decades-long incarceration for a crime he couldn't possibly have committed. Returning with us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Rabia Chowdhury. How you doing, Rabia?
Good. How are you, John?
I'm great. Also, we have James Fagorski. Jim was a Philadelphia police officer for 25 years. After he graduated from law school, Jim volunteered to assist the Pennsylvania Innocence Project to evaluate cases for merit, where he came upon the case of Sean Thomas. Thank you, and welcome back to the show, Jim.
Hi, John. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me back.
Also with us today is Marissa Boyers-Bluestein. She's been with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project since its inception in April 2009. Beginning as the project's legal director, she was made executive director in 2017. Marissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Marissa, so this is your first time on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and how it coalesced and came to be in Pennsylvania?
Sure. About 10 years ago, there was a group of lawyers here in Philadelphia who had been kind of meeting as in a form of a working group to say, you know, this is a phenomenon that's going on. Philadelphia doesn't have a project like this. We should really look into it. And then Barry Scheck came down to Philadelphia with Peter Neufeld, and a journalist out in Pittsburgh named Bill Mushi kind of came here and yelled at all of them and said, you know, we have to pick up the slack for you guys. Get an Innocence Project going. So the working project did exactly that, was able to raise some money, formed a nonprofit, and I was actually the first staff member that was hired back in April 2009. I had been at the public defender's office for about 10 years before that.
Got it. So it came together mostly because Barry Scheck was super mean.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say mean, but let's just say assertive.
But now, most Innocence Projects are based on DNA exonerations, but it sounds like you guys have branched out a bit. How did that decision come about?
It wasn't really a decision at all. I mean, most of the cases that we saw when we first started, it had nothing to do with DNA. There would never be a possibility for DNA. So we knew that if we were really going to be able to reach the approximately 4 or 5% of our 40,000 state inmates who are factually innocent, we would have to look beyond that. As challenging as it is, as difficult as it is, we knew that we'd have to be more than just a DNA project. So today we have about 26 cases in litigation all across the Commonwealth. And I think only about 5 of those even have the specter of DNA as a possibility.
So 26 cases requires an enormous amount of manpower. How many people are in the Pennsylvania Innocence Project?
Well, I'm 1/4 of the legal staff.
Okay.
So we're not very big, but thanks to people like Jim, who work at firms and are dedicated to these issues, we co-counsel with law firms and lawyers all across the state, and they increase the person power, you know, hundredfold. We have hundreds of volunteers, law students and community members and attorneys who help us screen the cases. And then once we actually get into litigation, we have just the best, most incredible pro bono partners, and the best of them all, of course, is Jim.
Of course. In terms of now that you guys have been in business, shall we say, since 2009, are you starting to notice patterns in wrongful convictions in Pennsylvania?
Let me put it this way. We are a member of the Innocence Network, which is a network of all the innocence organizations around the world. There's no mothership. We don't all report to the same administration. We're all independent, but we do work together. Very often when I'll put out a question to a listserv of all directors, I don't get back anything other than, wow, Pennsylvania really sucks. So we have a lot of difficulties. If it's an uphill battle and elsewhere, we're like facing Everest, because for a number of reasons, but predominantly it's just something that you've mentioned before in relation to Sean's case in particular, is the access to information. We are not entitled to discovery after you've been convicted, and your right to know law doesn't seem to think that any criminal defendant needs to know anything, because anything to do with a criminal investigation can be excluded from disclosure if the agency chooses. So it is extraordinarily difficult to do this kind of work in our state.
Is there a world in which it seems like in this case it's leading to a one particular officer who may be the source of a lot of wrongful convictions? Is there any situation where all of his or her cases can be reviewed en masse and looking for, you know, patterns of abuse of power?
Well, we've looked at exactly that. I mean, one thing that we started noticing early on was that we had a number of cases where there was this one detective or two or three detectives, all of whom were involved, all of which involved very similar complaints and charges of coercive behavior. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where if you hear it from one person, you kind of discount it. You hear from two, you kind of think, well, you know, it's just a coincidence. But when you hear from five, six, seven people who don't know each other, who are in different prisons scattered throughout the Commonwealth, but there are core commonalities, you start to think, well, maybe there's something here. And frankly, we don't just see that in Philadelphia. We see that in Harrisburg and in other areas around the Commonwealth as well, where it seems that you can find a core group of cases that seem to coalesce around a particular group of individuals. You've mentioned it in the last podcast about the Anthony Wright case. Anthony's case is just one. He's named five or six other defendants in that complaint who have similar allegations against those particular detectives.
And what is the status of Anthony Wright's case?
His case is pending. There's been a discovery issue going on over there that we've been somewhat involved in, and it is listed for trial in June.
And it also seems like many of these cases seem to spawn from the same time. The same time frame. Were there widespread patterns of things that law enforcement was dealing with at the time that might explain why these, you know, these wrongful convictions seem to cluster in certain areas, other than perhaps a core group of people that are just disrespecting the law?
Well, Jim can certainly talk about this from personal experience, but you're talking about a time when the murder rate in Philadelphia was astronomical. I mean, it was crushing, and so there was a huge pressure on the department to be able to solve these crimes and get out there and find who did it. So, you know, whether that accompanied a correlating, we don't particularly care who you get, just get someone, which seems to be some of the patterns that we see. It's the same era that produced an extraordinary case where police officers actually went to federal prison for essentially creating a confession against an innocent man. So it does seem to be a culture issue. The question that we really have is to what extent were prosecutors aware of it, looking the other way, you know, taking part in that? You know, we obviously don't know, and I don't certainly don't want to say anything that's not fully developed, but we have some concerns about that particular time period.
So that's fascinating. I did not know that police officers had been found criminally liable. We discussed in the podcast the concept of absolute immunity for prosecutors, but police officers don't have that as well?
Police officers have a more limited immunity. So it's still a very high threshold for a litigant to get over in order in a civil lawsuit. So there's what we call Section 1983 suits, where the individual is saying their civil rights were violated by police or prosecutors, and that it ended up in their wrongful conviction or their harm in some way. And while the prosecutors do, in fact, have essentially absolute immunity, police officers do not. But it's still a very, very high bar to get over.
Well, it sounds like when they call it absolute immunity, that sounds pretty big, I have to say. But that's enshrined in law. I mean, is there any chance of denting that in terms of, you know, I know there are some things that the Pennsylvania Innocence Project pursues in terms of trying to change legislation. Is that something that you guys are looking to try and change?
That issue about immunity is something really in Pennsylvania, at least, only the courts can change. And it's something in federal that only the courts can change. It's a court created issue. And so the courts have to deal with it themselves. So, you know, whether there's kind of an overall fix, that's harder to say. But what we're hopeful for is working with prosecutors' offices and with departments directly, we can help change the culture that produces that. So, for example, instead of having this very weird game of go fish as our current discovery practices, to encourage the prosecutors to have what we call an open file, meaning that they just give over everything that they have. That doesn't guarantee that the prosecutors are getting everything that the police have, but at least opens up some transparency in terms of the transfer of information between the prosecutors and defense counsel. And that's just one aspect of kind of changing the culture toward a culture of integrity of prosecutors' offices that we're seeing nationwide that we really kind of hope to start generating here in Pennsylvania.
ModCloth is your go-to spot for fashion as unique as you. ModCloth believes that fashion is for every body, size, and shape. That's why their exclusive line of apparel is offered in a full-size range from extra extra small to 4X. ModCloth is the go-to source for unique women's fashion. They specialize in a broad range of styles from quirky statement prints, vibrant colors, retro dresses, classic silhouettes, and cool contemporary clothing. You can even get free sizing and fit and styling help from their team of mod stylists. Effortlessly transition between seasons with summer styles that stay perfectly preserved for fall. Now, recently I got my wife the Library Love Striped Cardigan. The site was easy to navigate, the cardigan looks great, and the price was right. And now you too can go to ModCloth to find great clothes for yourself or your loved ones. Just go to ModCloth.com and enter the promo code UNDISCLOSED at checkout to get 30% off your order of $100 or more. That's ModCloth.com and the promo code is UNDISCLOSED. Make every day extraordinary at ModCloth.
So this case involved what now appear to be three false confessions. It seems like, first of all, just to me, you know, the sort of cliche about civil servants, you know, police officers, people in government is, you know, that they're lazy. But it seemed to me that sort of creating a three false confession case against Sean and Mustafa required an enormous amount of work. Also, it seems that there are obviously so many other avenues for the police to go after in that particular thing. The logic process for a police officer seems very unclear to me in this particular case. And perhaps Jim can chime in on this. But it seems like it would be very unlikely to get three false confessions about the same crime. Does that happen often?
At least two of those came from brothers, right?
Yes.
So you had John Stallworth and Sean Stallworth who were kind of in the mix together. And that according to Sean Stallworth, his confession was quite literally mirrored off of his brother's because the police showed it to him and said,
William, I just want to just to correct you, Marissa, I think you mean William Stallworth.
He goes by both.
He
prefers Sean as a nickname.
More confusing.
And does distinguish between our Sean and him. But thank
okay.
you. Yes. For those following the case, he's identified as William Stallworth.
Right. I've never mentioned him as Sean. And actually, I forgot about that. You're right. You guys mentioned that before.
When I've met with him, the several times I've met with him, it's always been Sean. But as he has explained it to me, that when the police brought him in, they showed him John's statement and told him, look, if you don't say the same thing, we're going after your brother and we're going to try to get the death penalty against him. And so out of some kind of familial loyalty, he felt he went along with it. So that at least explains why the two are, you know, so close and kind of mirror each other so much. And of course, the third was a relative of theirs. So it's probably not that attenuated out.
So, Jim, as a former police officer, to me, it seems like assembling a case this way, as opposed to just investigating it, requires an enormous amount of effort. And it seems odd that if, you know, if they just didn't want to pursue the other leads, what would be the impetus for police officers to try and create this case, considering that, you know, it's a lot of work every way you try it. You know, they're not saving work by doing this. I don't understand the impetus.
I think you're right in that had these detectives put as much work into the actual investigation rather than trying to get people, you know, to confess as they did, they might have cracked the case a lot easier and a lot sooner. But I think what happened here was, I think I mentioned it before, they went after what appeared to be the easier targets to them. It's harder to prove an inside job like that, especially when you have no real proof other than what appears to be obvious to us. In this case, he had people, or these detectives had people who were in jail. They were in a weak position, and they thought that they could get them to confess easily. And it turns out that they did. With very little effort, they apparently got these guys right into a room, and they confessed in no time. Now, in William Stallworth's case, it took at least two interrogations that we know of. But in John's, as soon as they sat him down, apparently, according to them, he told them right away that he was involved in the murder. So I think it was easier for them to pursue the case against the guys in the Abbotsford homes than it was to look at these possible other suspects.
But interestingly, Sean and Mustafa never confessed. Now, why do you think that was?
Sean said that he was brought into a room and asked to confess by the detectives, and he refused. He told them he didn't do it and he wasn't going to confess. And he told me he would never confess because he would never admit that he did something that he didn't do. Everybody's different. when you look at the long list of false confessions, you know, particularly those involving DNA evidence, you can see that for some reason, some people confess and some do not. I mean, some people can be smacked around in this interrogation room and they refuse to back down, whereas other people just have a weaker will and, you know, for some reason confess when they did not do the crime.
Yeah, I think most people just have the feeling of themselves that they just simply wouldn't. You know, I would never falsely confess. You know, I can't imagine a set of circumstances where I would just say, yeah, you know, I murdered that lady. You know, I just it wouldn't happen. But as I think you guys have shown, the situations get sufficiently complicated and suddenly it looks better and better.
It does. Right, exactly. And it's also kind of impossible to put yourself in the situation where some of these people are. I mean, you're talking about being in a very small room with two detectives who are on top of you, who are not accepting the fact that you were saying you didn't do it. And the feeling of, you know, despair that someone would come in, that if I don't do what they're saying I should do, which I'm not suggesting is in this case, but we do see in many false confessions, if you, that level of despair might lead someone to say, look, I don't see any other way out. I got to just do what they're telling me to do.
Now, I wanted to get to the missing homicide file that was missing for how long? What, 20 plus years it was missing, supposedly?
I'm not sure how long it was actually missing from the police department. I mean, when I first tried to find it, it was 2013 or so. And I was told it was missing at that time. How long it had been missing before that, I don't know.
So what are the document retention policies for the police department there? I mean, is it different for every department?
I think each department sets its own policies regarding, you know, document retention. I'm not sure what the police department has. I'd have to look at it. They have a rather long and complicated policy. But regarding homicide files, I'm not sure. I know that we tried to get numerous other police reports involving Sean Thomas's arrest the day before the murder. And they had been destroyed years ago. I think their document retention policies for that were 10 years. However, I know that they're retaining many, if not all, of the old homicide files.
Well, I imagine it's just an enormous amount of paperwork. You know, if every officer is tracking what they do every day, if every prosecutor has to track every document that they make and they produce, and everybody has to keep track of every piece of evidence that comes in, and there's, of course, receipts that are given for that evidence, and when evidence is passed around to be tested and such like that, that generates paperwork. This is an enormous amount of paperwork. Does Pennsylvania have a particular problem managing their paperwork, or is that just universal?
Yeah, I think it's universal. I don't think that we have a particular problem in retaining. I think we may just have a particular aversion to doing so. But part of the problem, too, is not just what records they retain, but what records they create. And the more we move into, say, a digital communication system, you know, are they taking moves to retain text messages between a detective and a witness, or emails, or Instagrams, or Facebook posts, you know, or are they just kind of disappearing into ether? So it's certainly a problem reaching back in time, but it's probably even more so a problem reaching forward.
Is there any liability? I mean, considering that, like, a defendant could be incarcerated for many years while they don't have access to a missing file, is there any way for somebody who is perhaps, you know, who ends up having their conviction vacated, forcing any kind of liability on the state?
Yeah, if the city fails to follow its own policy and it destroys evidence where it should have retained the evidence, then yes. And what you can do is you can get a negative inference at trial that had this evidence been favorable, then they would have produced it and they wouldn't have destroyed it. But there's no actual liability in itself. Well, I mean, you can't sue over the missing files. You can bring it up as an evidentiary issue, but it's not a cause of action by itself.
So, Jim, I wanted to ask you a few questions in terms of they laid out some different suspects in this last episode of Undisclosed, but they all seemed to me to have things that made them less than they all were absolutely, you know, would have been exculpatory in terms of had they been presented at trial, they absolutely would have muddied the waters in terms of the prosecution. Were there any that jumped out as you as this is a real possibility for the suspect, for the actual perpetrator of this?
Yes, there was. The one person who was interviewed 3 days after the homicide when he was stopped in the car, and it was never clear to me whether he was a driver or an actual passenger in the car, is the man who's now in prison for murder. And that murder took place a few months after, you know, the Martinez murder, within a couple of blocks of that murder. And it was another store owner, and there were three people who did that murder. And at least one of those suspects in that murder, in the, you know, the murder that happened, you know, a few months after the Martinez murder, is one of the other people who was in that car. And the person who I'm talking about, who's in prison after that murder, is the one who said, I was in the bar, you know, the day after the murder, and I heard this guy talking, and I know him, and he said that he bumps and robs people for a living, and he said he robbed this old Puerto Rican guy, and he was flashing all kinds of money around. And I got the distinct impression that he was putting that crime off on somebody else, because he was, and he said, I was afraid they were going to charge me with that crime. And he had very good reason to think so, because he was in a car that fit the description, and he and you know, the men he were with, you know, they also fit the description, and he was a violent guy who had shot people and robbed people. So he was not, I mean, my number one suspect, but I'm not sure what the city's going to do with that.
That car was the gray car, not the red and white car that, according to the witnesses that to Ron Smith and the other witnesses that they saw actually ramming Domingo Martinez's car. So it wouldn't be necessarily the same car. I mean, I have all kinds of car questions. Like, I was wondering, was Domingo Martinez's car actually found at his address? The guy who found it in the same place where Domingo Martinez generally left it, was that actually where the car was found?
It was one of the locations where Mr. Martinez owned a property. So Mr. Martinez owned a property in that block, so it's not unusual that he would have his car parked there. What, you know, how often it was parked there or not, I don't know, because the police never really, you know, delved any further into that possibility. So we only have the one statement from this man who said that he knew Martinez for 39 years. He saw the car parked there the night before, and it was parked in the exact same spot the next day, only now it had a bullet hole in the windshield and the trunk was open.
Yeah, I understand that. But so the police have no record of where the car was actually found?
I mean, they know where it was found. It was found in the 2100 block of North 2nd Street in Philadelphia.
So it was moved from there.
It was found there within about, I guess, you know, 45 minutes after the murder. And it was found because the people on that block called to report that there was something wrong with that car. So, yeah, it was moved away from the murder scene. What happened was after the shooting, yeah, Mr. Martinez was dragged out of the car into the street, and the person who shot him jumped into Martinez's car and drove it away, and drove it approximately a mile away and parked it and left, and obviously took the money out of the trunk as well.
And did the police have any record of, did they go over the car for prints, or was there any usable evidence from the car?
They did. They found 10 latent prints in the car on the steering wheel and in the driver's side area. Inside of the car. We found that, there were fingerprints found, and myself and Marissa asked the DA if they could test those fingerprints now that they have the ACES system. In 1990, there was no nationwide database where they could search fingerprints. So they said was there was nobody linked to those, or who was involved in the investigation who was linked to those prints. Well, now they might be able to find somebody by running those prints through the ACES system, which is the Automated Fingerprint Information System, I believe it stands for. And they could not find the prints anymore.
So those have been lost?
As far as I know. I mean, they're either lost or misplaced. They just don't know where they are.
So, but that wouldn't be just a robbery, right? I mean, because the suspect you were mentioning, he was just doing it to rob. It wasn't an arranged hit by the family or anything like that.
I don't know. I mean, he did do at least one robbery, apparently. That's what he's in prison for a robbery and murder. But whether he could have been hired by somebody to do this murder as well, because he's a known person who uses violence, I'm not sure.
One thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of how police officers go about their day, we talk about that when police produce evidence that could be exculpatory, they're hesitant to hand it over. Does that actually flavor the way that police officers investigate stuff? Do they decide, I'm just not going to go down that road because it's, going to be dangerous to my case?
I think maybe in some circumstances they do that. Yes. Now, whether that's what they did here, I don't know. Obviously, they went down that road and just didn't turn certain things over. Whether that's their usual practice or not, I'm not sure. I haven't seen enough of their cases to be able to say for sure.
Well, I have to imagine unconscious bias would come into it. I mean, even if you're a dedicated police officer and you're not just trying to frame somebody, you're dealing with a lot of gray areas. I mean, wouldn't you say that's the case, Jim?
I would say so. And I think that they do have bias. I think they form their own ideas about how the murder happened, and they're very, I'd say, reluctant to change their minds regardless of the evidence. I mean, there's obviously times when they do, I remember being at the scene of a homicide one time when I was a sergeant in uniform in West Philadelphia and speaking to some of the witnesses to the murder. And what they told me was this happened about 2 o'clock in the morning behind, you know, an old convenience store. And they told me that the man who, you know, was shot had been back there meeting with two other men in a car, and they sat in the car talking for, you know, like a half an hour. And all of a sudden, those two guys, you know, jumped out and, you know, shot the man and left. They took off in their car. And when I was holding the scene there, and when, you know, about a half hour later, you know, some homicide detectives showed up, and I remember saying, hey, I spoke to some of these witnesses. I think this might have been a bad drug deal or something, the way this happened here. They all knew each other. And he had just arrived at the scene and said, no, this is a straight-up robbery. And I said, how do you know? And he says, because I know. And I went, okay. You know, whatever you say. I mean, he hadn't spoken to a single witness or seen the scene yet, and he knew what happened. And I just thought, hey, I don't know. But I'm not sure where that, you know, where that job ever went, but I had my doubts about that one.
So what is Mustafa's status right now?
Mustafa has, or he's, you know, he's in the process of a, you know, PCRA, which is, you know, the Pennsylvania Post-Conviction Relief Act. He was also on appeal, as was Sean, because both cases were dismissed at the same time. But due to the newly discovered evidence of the, you know, the homicide file, his case has been remanded back to Common Pleas Court, and there's going to be, I don't think it's been scheduled yet, but there's going to be an evidentiary hearing for, you know, for Mustafa.
I don't understand why his case is being treated differently than Sean's.
I think, and I'm not sure, but I think it's because Sean had the alibi of the Youth Study Center, and Mustafa did not. It's as plain as that. They just, I think that this case has no credibility at all based on what we've seen, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. I mean, I don't believe any of it anymore. But I think the Commonwealth is not going to admit that as long as they don't have more clear evidence to clear, you know, Mustafa, and you have to show definitively that, you know, he did not do it.
Now, is there ever going to be a possibility of the state, you know, considering the other possibilities, the suspect you mentioned, the possibility that the family might have been involved, is considering that Sean has now been exonerated and could well happen for Mustafa, is there any chance for the city to reopen the case?
I doubt it. I'd like to see that, but I doubt it. Marissa and I brought that up actually to the DA's office, and they said it wasn't up to them. It's up to the police department, and I don't think the police department wants to open up another murder. I think their attitude is they have enough active ones to deal with. They're not going to look at an old homicide.
I mean, our take on it is that, you know, we would like Philadelphia to do what Brooklyn did. When Brooklyn was faced with, you know, I think just one case of a detective who had engaged in very improper conduct, the district attorney's office, under the leadership of their DA, Ken Thompson, decided to pull every case that that detective had been a part of and review it themselves internally to see whether there were other cases that had been affected. And I believe that they have, to date, exonerated 17 individuals out of that pool. Now, that's not everybody, of course, and probably it's a small number, but they lost confidence in those 17 cases and withdrew prosecution and, in fact, agreed to a motion to get the individual released and the charges dismissed. I don't see why that's not feasible here when you have a core group of officers from the same time period, from the same department, where there are very similar allegations of misconduct, and one case where they've already withdrawn prosecution, another case where a jury acquitted within 5 minutes of having the evidence presented to them. You know, that, I would hope, would raise enough red flags for the prosecutor's office to say, hey, you know, we really should be looking at these cases as a whole instead of on these one-to-ones. And I know that that's a funding issue. I know that that's a resource issue, but it's still it's something that we think is very critical for understanding what happened in these cases. One, to see how it impacted the culture of the police department going forward. Two, to identify those cases of people who may in fact be innocent at the hands of these detectives, and three, ensure that it doesn't happen again by instituting better training and culture for the department going forward.
Is there any real hope for this? I mean, politically, you know, people are still so frightened of, you know, crime statistics are not, I don't think they're being rationally presented to the public. Does the Innocence Project make any effort to, at public information? I imagine this, actually, this podcast is part of that effort. But are there any other efforts you guys are making? Because I feel like crime statistics are so often abused by politicians. A little real information, we'd be grateful. For.
And real information and real data are simply critical to be able to having systemic reform. I mean, we are about to have an election here in the city of Philadelphia. In about 5 weeks, we'll elect a new district attorney. And we, of course, have reached out to both candidates to discuss this issue with them and kind of express our hope that we could work with whichever administration comes out to try to get the funding, get the resources, and get the interest in trying to dig into these cases, because we can't just keep papering it over. That doesn't make any sense. It certainly is horrific for the human tragedy of the individuals who may be in prison right now, who are in fact innocent. But it also just, you can't have this blind eye, ostrich in the sand, whatever metaphor you want, and kind of pretend it didn't happen and, oh, well we're better now. Well, we don't know that we're better now until we know why we were wrong and bad in the past. And so I do think it's something that's critical for this city, particularly at this juncture, to understand these cases and really understand them in a very deep way.
Jim, having been a part of the police force, what do you think needs to change in the police culture?
Well, I think that the idea of, you know, we don't ask how, just how many has to change. And I saw that throughout my career, and I was a part of it myself. I mean, it was all about numbers. At the time, I think it was the only way the police department knew how to operate was just through, you know, through numbers and stats. How many people did we arrest? How many murders did we clear? And I think there's more to it than that. They actually have to be looking at who actually did it and why are we arresting so many people for minor crimes and how can we avoid putting innocent people in prison? I mean, how do we learn the lessons of the past? And I think that's, you know, it's that. I think it's actually started under Charles Ramsey when he was there as commissioner. And I think Marissa can tell you that. He did adopt some policies that were, you know, I think pretty forward looking and progressive in that, you know, I think Marissa took him, you know, a new policy, you know, concerning IDs and had identified people from, you know, from photo spreads and from lineups. And he, you know, he accepted them. He thought they were pretty good. And he's also changed, you know, he and Richard Ross have, you know, changed the way the homicide, the homicide unit does business. They don't use coercive techniques, at least as far as I know anymore. They do film their, you know, their interrogations now where they never did before. And I don't think it's been popular, you know, there in some circles, but I think it's, you know, a step in the right direction.
Now, Rabia, did you have any questions?
No, but our listeners have tons.
Yes, they do. We've got a bunch of them. Some of them we've actually already dealt with. But here's one. And this is somebody who clearly either listens to a lot of legal podcasts or is in the business, as they say, is a lawyer. This is from Ella McSee. Who says, any cases regarding poor Brady / open discovery in PA submitted to SCOTUS? Obviously, the Supreme Court. The PA system seems contrary to Brady disposition. Okay, I don't know what this person is saying. Can somebody explain to me what this person is saying?
Any system that seems to withhold discovery seems to at least violate the spirit of Brady. And Brady is a United States Supreme Court decision from 1963, which held that the government has to turn over any evidence which is exculpatory. And that's all fine and good. But, you know, there's so many limitations on that. For one, you know, in reality, the only information they have to turn over is information which is exculpatory, but material. In other words, so important to the case that if it is withheld, it would be an unfair proceeding. So the prosecutor actually has to look at the evidence, go, number one, is this exculpatory or not? Which they literally may not be able to see because of their own implicit biases of looking at this particular evidence through the lens of somebody, you know, this person committed the crime, but they also have to kind of be a little bit of a fortune teller to say, well, if I don't turn this over, you know, and I get caught later, could it possibly have had an impact on the trial? And that's really an untenable standard. And yet that is the national standard that we have to deal with. So it's not so much that if there's a case that's been presented and that this current court is really not all that excited about going back into Brady and kind of looking at it again. There was a decision just from last month in a case involving a gentleman named Turner and five other defendants where the court could have taken a great leap forward and, in fact, chose to kind of toe that line pretty strongly. So I don't know that in this particular judicial milieu that we have a lot of success on that going forward, which is why we think working with prosecutors' offices to voluntarily adopt open file discovery practices is really the better way to go.
But in Pennsylvania, you're always going to be dealing with the fact that there's the layer where the police don't turn everything over to the prosecutor. Is that correct?
That is correct. Pennsylvania does not have a centralized law enforcement system. And in fact, we have approximately 1,200 law enforcement agencies across the Commonwealth. To put that in perspective, California has about 600, and they have much more, a greater population than we. So we are an extraordinarily fragmented state in terms of law enforcement, yet again reminding you that people always tell me, wow, Pennsylvania sucks. But it's not something that we think is undoable. We work directly with law enforcement to try to encourage some of these policies and procedures. And yes, it's a long road, but we're on that road and we're committed to it.
Okay. We got one from Emmy Award who says, any more info on how Sean's file was actually found? I read a Times article that said it was in a box in a hallway.
That's pretty much what we know. From what we've been told, it was in a box in the hallway at police headquarters. And we haven't heard anything since. So that's as far as we know. That's it.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that, Jim, about the file? Because you had said in your interview with me earlier that when you went to the archives, you were told it had been signed out and then never returned. So, wouldn't they have to have the name of the person? The record's not going to say, well, signed out. I mean, to know that it was signed out, you have to have a name, right? Why could they confirm that it was signed out but not give you a name is what I'm wondering.
Well, there were two things to that. I mean, first of all, they wouldn't tell me because I had no right to know. And it was almost like, a top secret issue. They couldn't tell me anything other than it wasn't there. But the other thing is the person hinted to me that he couldn't read the signature. Oh. So he couldn't tell who did it anyway.
Right. And remember, we don't know that the file that was turned over was part of the file which they couldn't find. From what we understand, the file that was turned over was actually at the police department and not where it should have been at the archives.
There's apparently, I've been told two different files. There's the main homicide file, which I believe is what they found, because we still have never seen the file. We've only seen the items that were taken from it that, the DA's office found that was, the Brady issue. And there's apparently some kind of a binder that was turned over to the DA's office. And I'm not sure, but there may be confusion about what was actually at the archives. The big binder of material or the actual box full of documents, which is the actual homicide file.
Okay, I'm confused. So there's more than one main file where they keep everything?
No, there's one main file, but apparently when we were asking people at the DA's office for the file, I think what they're saying is they had a file and it was what the police department gave them, not necessarily the police department's file. So apparently what happens is when they're preparing for trial, and this is my understanding, I'm not sure if this is correct, the homicide detectives copy everything that they need for the trial, and they give it to the DA, all the witness statements, anything else that they need to prosecute the case and to prep the witnesses, and they give that to the DA's office and whoever's going to prosecute the case, but they retain the actual homicide file, which is their box of documents and photographs and everything else.
Jim, when I was looking back at some of the documents that were turned over to you guys later, the email exchange in which it was confirmed that the prosecutor met with the youth study intake guy, Brian Cohen, that happened in November of 2016, I believe, right? So this conviction review unit, that's what it's called, right? The CRU, they had confirmed last fall at some point that, or it seems like they had confirmed that, back in the day, the prosecutor confirmed that Sean was there, but that confirming the alibi wasn't enough. It was specifically the Brady stuff about these other guys or do you think it was a combination of these two factors that made them throw out the case?
I think it was the combination, because in April they confirmed to us, they being the CRU, confirmed to us that they had come to the consensus that Sean Thomas was likely at the Youth Study Center at the time of the murder. But that didn't lead to his release. What actually led to his release was the discovery of the homicide file and the Brady issue.
Well, if that's the case, then why wouldn't that be enough for Mustafa as well? Because that applies likewise, regardless of the alibi issue.
I absolutely think it is. And I'm very curious to see what argument they make in the Brady hearing. So
will Sean's release impact that hearing, do you think? Like,
I don't know. It's before the same judge, so she's certainly aware that Sean was released. I mean, she's the one who issued his order, vacating the conviction. So I'm not really sure how she's going to handle that or what effect it's going to have on her.
Here's one from I'm a Carrie 4, who says, when he knew or at least believed misconduct was rampant in the PPD and PDA's office, why didn't Fogorsky leave? Did Fogorsky and Krasner ever report these DAs they heard talking about convicting innocent people to the state bar?
Well, I think it was Krasner who heard that, not Fogorsky.
Yes.
I think it was Larry Krasner who said that he heard DA saying that. I never heard anyone at the DA's office say that, because I didn't work around those people, so I wouldn't have heard that. What I saw, and I never saw any outright bad conduct on the part of homicide detectives. I can't say that I did, because I didn't work with them. I saw things that I suspected. I read stories in the paper that didn't make sense about people being convicted, and my people took statements from people who were witnesses who said that, this guy didn't do it, and we turned that information over, and nothing was ever done about it. And as I said before, I think it was pretty credible evidence. It wasn't just, hey, I heard that this guy did it and it happened this way. I was there. I saw it. It didn't happen the way they said it did, and I'd be willing to testify to that.
Yeah, it's different when you have firsthand knowledge of something, I would imagine. This one is from Iva T., who says, how is it possible that a DA's office vacates someone's sentence, given and confirmed by a court? I understand that a DA decides not to litigate further, but to vacate a previous standing conviction? I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm happy. It actually says, I'm happy AF, and I won't go into what that means. I'm happy AF that George is a free man now. I just don't understand. I don't know what – I think they mean Sean. But but at any rate, their question is, if a CRU, are they empowered to just vacate a conviction completely?
Well, it's not just a CRU, but it's any prosecutor's office certainly has that power. So once the decision – so, I mean, it really is kind of a two-part issue. For Sean's case, they found information which unquestionably they were required to turn over at the time of trial. They violated Sean's constitutional rights. The penalty for that is taking away the conviction that they got by cheating. There's no other remedy for the law. So once that remedy is given, because the other alternative is just, oops, so sorry, we violated your constitutional rights, you were convicted, you shouldn't have been, enjoy your life at SCI Mahanoy. The real solution to that is to say, okay, fine, we'll do it over again. So then when you get to the question of, okay, fine, we'll do it over again, for Sean's case, there were really two considerations. One, can we put together a trial which would indicate guilt of Sean Thomas? And two, do we as prosecutors believe that he was actually involved in this? They never got to the second question, or at least they never admitted to the second question, because the response was, we don't feel we can ethically prosecute Sean Thomas because of the strong evidence that he was not involved in this case. So that's why I think the question with what happens to his brother is particularly interesting, because like Jim said earlier, they don't have that same strong evidence that he wasn't where he was. So why do they agree to it? Because it's the right thing to do. It is the ethical, procedurally ethical, correct thing to do, the professional thing to do, the constitutionally sound thing to do, and just the morally right thing to do.
And I think it was also, part of the question was also, how does that work? How does a DA just say, we agree to vacate the conviction? Well, we were in court already, and we had filed a PCRA seeking to have Sean's conviction overturned. And, the DA opposed that. And I think what happened was the DA just stopped opposing it. And, they agreed to overturn the conviction as we asked. So it wasn't just the DA saying, hey, we're going to overturn this conviction. We were already in court. We were before a judge. We were actually on appeal. And the court had heard both sides of us, was waiting to make a decision. And then they, when they found the new evidence, they said, we're not going to oppose this anymore. We're going to agree to him being released.
Okay, we have another question from MC Raghead, who says, what happened with the others in the Sean Thomas case? Were their convictions vacated as well, the co-defendants? I imagine they're talking about the Stallworths.
The Stallworths. Yeah, the Stallworths were not vacated. They've served their time. They're out. They haven't challenged anything.
Mm-hmm. They've made no effort to have the convictions expunged. I imagine it would be a great expense. And for people who are already out on the street, I imagine they probably don't feel the need at this point.
Exactly.
But of course, once you've been convicted and you have that on your record, that makes your life very, very difficult. I can understand people going both ways on that.
I also wanted to ask, actually, John Stallworth was the one who got that plea deal, even though he served his time and is out. And I think his probation period is over, too, if I'm not incorrect. Can that plea still be revoked after all these years?
No, it can't. Well, I mean, right now, the only way to do it procedurally is to seek a pardon from the governor, because the PCRA only allows a person serving a sentence in prison or being on probation or parole to, you know, to go into court and challenge that sentence. So the only way to do it would be to seek, you know, seek the governor and ask him for, a pardon.
Right. I mean, I was going to say that the other option would be to do a joint filing with the district attorney's office to vacate. But of course, we saw what happened in a similar case where the district attorney actually agreed to relief for us with us and the judge denied it. So, you know, that's not a done deal either.
Yeah, I don't understand why a judge would deny a district attorney coming to them and saying, you know, this doesn't hold any water anymore.
I'm going to once again remind you the response I get from my Innocence Network colleagues. Wow, Pennsylvania sucks.
One last question from a listener. Actually, this is from Pernille BD. As someone who lives outside the U.S., I do not understand the logic behind the DA being an elected and political position. Does anybody have any insight into how that arose, that a district attorney is an elected official?
Not really. It's been that way. I mean, I never thought
it's been a head scratcher.
Been that way in Pennsylvania, as long as anybody can remember. Most places, I believe, have elected DAs. And I believe it's just because we have a tradition here of electing, you know, just about everybody we can. And, you know, we elect judges in Pennsylvania. Right. They stand for election and they have campaigns. So I don't think it's unusual in the states to have elections of prosecutors and judges and things like that.
Boy, it's a license for corruption. I mean, we're obviously dealing with right now a lot of allegations about a district attorney in New York who received multiple political donations and just happened to drop certain cases. The DA may well have had good reasons for dropping these cases, but it sure looks bad. It's very hard to pull that apart.
Our district attorney is sitting in a federal cell right now.
So there you go. Is the system itself an invitation for corruption that will have to be decided? Well, thank you guys so much for coming. Did you guys have any last thoughts that you wanted to impart?
Just one thing, if I could. On September 20th of this year, myself and two other lawyers from Deckard filed suit against the city of Philadelphia and three former police officers, in federal court. You know, and we're alleging that they violated Sean Thomas's rights under color of state law, under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act. So Deckard, my firm, took this case pro bono for free. We're not charging Sean any fee at all. We believe in him and in his case, and we're waiting for discovery in this case right now. So hopefully it'll go well.
Well, good luck.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
And Marissa, thank you again for being here. And we're going to imagine be dealing with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project quite a bit more on the next series that we're doing with. So I imagine you and I are going to get very, very close.
There you go. we've not just been grateful for the work of Rabia and Colin and Susan, just been amazingly impressed. I mean, if I had the money, believe me, I'd try to hire all three of you to work for me full time. But it just is so extraordinary to us, the level of commitment, diving down into these old cases, reading things that really can't be read, and trying to find the truth. I mean, listening to this whole podcast, even though I lived through it, I still had to rewind it a few times and go, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. That just sounds too crazy. And kind of staying with us through the whole rabbit hole has really been an extraordinary experience.
Well, thank you for trusting us to tell Sean's story and the stories that are coming up. One thing I just want to say, what's interesting is, we started off with Sean's story. It's kind of opened the floodgates, not just with cases from you guys, but so many other people have messaged us from the area saying, I've got more cases for you. I've got more cases, all from Philly, from that era. And it's kind of overwhelming. I don't know how long we're going to be doing Philly cases, but it sounds like we could do it for quite a while if we wanted to.
Yeah, and I would just ask anybody who's listening that if you have a case that you're concerned about, please, please, please contact the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. This is what we're here for. We very much want to hear about those cases and see if there's any way that we can help.
Thank you so much, Marissa and Jim, and I'm sure we will talk further. And thank you, Rabia.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, John. Thanks, guys. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is it for this week's addendum. We will be off next week, but we will be returning in two with a brand new case and a brand new addendum. Remember, all the case documents and photos are posted at undisclosed-podcast.com, as well as a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. And as I said, I will be donating all of my fees to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project this season. And you can help them as well at their website, innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle, @UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I wanted to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, once more for his fantastic research, as well as Hannah McCarthy for her editing, and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Methil Telhan one more time as our project manager. Thank you all for listening this week, and I can't wait to come back in a couple more.